Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes, yes.
Yes, we are back for another fabulous episode of season five, guys.
I almost said season two because I cannot wrap my head around the fact that we're on season five.
I know.
How did we do that?
Because we're fabulous, because we're hotties.
Oh my God, I almost forgot.
And you know who else are hotties and fabulous?
Tell me.
Our listeners.
Because, that's right.
Because they are sharing our podcast with all their friends. They're liking and subscribing. They're sharing the podcast by copying the link and sending it to people. That's what they're doing.
They're so great.
Yes, they
are. You guys
are
amazing.
Yes, you are. And if you are actually watching this on YouTube, go ahead and hit that like button and subscribe so you will get notifications the next time we upload new videos. So I think that because I know you said you had something that's a little bit longer today. So let's get started.
A little bit. Yeah.
And I believe this week you are first, my dear. So
it's me. It is still Black History Month.
Yes. When this comes out, yes.
Yes. Thank you for the shortest month. Okay.
Actually, this year, we're in a leap year.
Oh.
So it comes out on the 29th, the very last day of Black History Month.
That's right. Suckers.
So. Yes.
Did you see what, I posted this on our Instagram? About what if there was white, if things were switched. Mm-hmm. Clarabelle Talks, you guys, we follow her, we love her. She does these switched, instead of Black History Month, it would be if white America. So it's it's European History Month. Mm-hmm. Salmon, can you stand up and talk about your experience being having your stringy blonde hair? I mean, it's
finding shampoo.
Is it hard for you? Can you tell the class what it's like? It's
wait a
so
minute.
On point.
No, I just got this. The kid's name is Salmon.
Yes, I live for it.
I cannot. Is that a nod to your to the Norwegian?
I'm pointing to my complexion, y'all.
Oh my God, Salmon. That's hilarious. The poor baby. Now somebody's going to name the child Salmon. I can't.
Thinking that it's right. What?
Oh my God. Or okay. Salmon and herring. Salmon and herring
salmon
are
and
twins.
Herring. Yes, the twins. Okay.
I can't.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm sweating.
Oh my God. Yes, that's hilarious.
Could be menopause. I don't know.
Oh my God. Okay, that's hilarious.
So let's get started, right?
Yeah.
We said that we were going to do that. Let's do that.
Yeah. So who is your notorious woman this week?
My notorious woman this week is Althea Gibson.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay, I see you.
Now,
okay.
Okay. Now, I kind of did know about her because I'm special.
I know a little bit about her, full disclosure. I don't know. So I'm very excited. I'm going to learn something new today.
Because I didn't know that there was more. And you're all like, what? Well, I'll explain.
Okay.
So she was born on August 25th, 1927, in the town of Silver in Clarendon County, South Carolina, to Daniel and Annie Bell Gibson. And they were sharecroppers on a cotton farm. So apparently, I did not know this, in the South, the rural farms down there got the Great Depression hit them much earlier than the rest of the country. So the family upped and moved to Harlem as part of the Great Migration. So that's basically where she grew up. And that's when she has three sisters and a brother, and they were born in Harlem.
Oh, that's so interesting.
She was the oldest.
Because I always thought of her as a northerner. So that would explain it. Why? Yeah.
Yeah. So she was in her. But, I feel like your family's energy, where their history is.
Yeah.
Does play a part in your psyche a little.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So their apartment was located on a stretch of 143rd Street. Cute. I have a friend who lives on that street. Between Lenox Avenue and 7th Avenue, which was a designated police athletic league play area. So, which is amazing.
That is amazing.
They should do that again.
Yes.
During daylight hours, it was barricaded so that neighborhood children could play organized sports. What?
I love that. For the
That's
kiddies.
That's awesome.
Yep.
So real quick, she became real good at something called paddle tennis. I mean, I assume it's like smaller versions of tennis. I bet you it's like pickleball.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what pickleball is? Just table tennis?
What? Listen, a lot of people love pickleball, and I think you just offended all of them. But
I'm sorry.
it looks to me like it's like live table tennis.
Okay.
But the table is the court. I don't know. I definitely want to try it.
Okay.
It looks like something I would love.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to run so much, you know?
Yeah. Me either.
Right? And we could be like, we're sports. We're doing sports, you know?
We're doing sports,
and we're drinking a beer too, you know?
Exactly.
So by 1939, she was 12 years old and she became New York City women's paddle tennis champion. 12 years old.
I had no idea.
Yeah, right? So she apparently she quit school when she was 13, and started street fighting. Like her father taught her boxing skills. And so she was like street fighting. She played basketball and she would like watch movies. She basically dropped out of school. And
wait a minute. When you say street fighting, do you mean like
she would pick fights
organized
with other kids?
Oh, okay. I was going to say like,
I don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So her father taught her boxing because she's obviously a tomboy and she's like, I'm going to use these skills on these motherfuckers out in these streets.
But she quit school and apparently she was scared of her father. So she ended up spending some time living in a Catholic protective shelter for kids who had issues at home who were abused. So I don't know.
Huh.
It's a rough childhood, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in 1940, which was soon after, a group of her neighbors took up a collection to finance a junior membership and lessons at the Cosmopolitan Tennis Club in the Sugar Hill section of Harlem.
Aww.
Right? So they like got her back, you know? So she actually didn't like tennis at first. I love this fact. Nope. Because she thought it was for weak people. I love her.
Althea is scrappy. I love that.
Yes.
Yeah.
A quote from her. I kept wanting to fight the other player every time I started to lose a match. End quote.
Okay, wait a minute. Yeah. This is really blowing my mind. Uh-huh. The Althea Gibson, who is like the image of like tennis and you know, all the little white skirts and like, you know, tennis is like, is like, I got so mad I want to lay hands on these people.
I am an acceptable black woman in all these pictures when she was a kid.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I can relate. She went from fight kids in the street to being like, motherfucker, I will fight you on the tennis court. Oh my God, this makes me love her even more.
I know, right?
Totally. That's awesome.
But then in 1941, she did enter her first tournament and she won it. So I think she was like, okay, well, if I can win, it's fine.
Right, right.
But remember, she's like a teenager. She's like 14, 15 years old. She's still a kid.
Oh my God. You know. That's the best.
And then, so in 1944 and 1945, she won the American Tennis Association National Championship in the girls' division. Okay. So then in 46, she lost, but then won her first of 10 straight national ATA women's titles in 1947. So she like won, lost, and then won 10 more times.
I guess after she lost, she's like, that's not going to happen again.
Yeah, so she's like, I'm angry and they wouldn't let me punch her in the face. So So here's what I'm going to do instead.
Oh my God. I love this. This is me at that age. Like, yes. I will punch you in your face, motherfucker.
As I was researching her, I'm like, oh my God, this is Lovetta.
Oh yeah. I can relate. Miss Athea Gibson. I get you, girl. Like, I get you.
Because she was so successful, she drew attention to people who were active in the tennis community. And Walter Johnson, who was a Lynchburg, Virginia physician, was very active in the African-American tennis community. And under his patronage, she gained access to more advanced instruction and more important competitions. And later to the United States Lawn Tennis Association. In 1946, so this is around 1945, 46, this is how she's like building up and how she was, you know, to some degree lucky, right?
Well, she was nurtured. That's what you have to do with young people. Nurtured. Right. Yeah.
Like, I think it's important to point out that she was nurtured and people took notice and then gave her more than she could get on her own.
Yep.
Because that's how it's done. No one just does it because...
Takes a village.
Yep. Takes a village, man. Takes a village.
Which, by the way, is an African proverb that Miss Hillary Clinton used. So just wanted to set the record straight.
Oh.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah. And I think she had even said it's an African proverb, but for some reason they never mentioned that. And they're like, oh, it's Hillary Clinton. I'm like, no.
It's not Hillary Clinton. She just likes it.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Because it's true.
It's so true. I'm a mom. It's so true. I'm tired. Sorry. Off topic.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. No. You were saying.
You're not the problem. okay. So in 46, she moved to Wilmington, North Carolina under the sponsorship of another physician. All these physicians and tennis, like, activists. Wow, I didn't know that was like a combination of people.
Well, yeah, for Black people, they would have to, you know, Black professionals. Yeah,
I mean, my guess is that because they were able to get to a certain level of income, then they could then use that privilege to give to the community.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yep.
Hubert A. Eaton is his name. And she enrolled in the racially segregated Williston Industrial High School. I don't have much more information about how much fun that was for her. Can't imagine it was too fun. I think it's interesting because she was in the North and then went to the South to practice tennis.
And as we've established, Miss Athea Gibson was not above getting them hands out, putting them on people. So I would imagine there's a lot of racist white kids got a foot up their ass.
I certainly hope so. I'm not like a proponent of violence, like in general. Like if you're listening, like if the FBI right now is like listening, like no, violence is bad. But like if it happened, like am I angry about it?
These kids, and also you have to leave it amongst kids, like they're kids, so. Adults should be stepping in and being like, no. Like,
right. Also, you know. Stop being racist at this segregated school. Yeah. Anyways, this country is so fucked up. Anyways, in 1949, she became the first Black woman and the second Black athlete to play in the USTA's National Indoor Championships, where she reached the quarterfinals. Okay. Yeah. She then later that year entered Florida A&M University on a full athletic scholarship.
Oh, FAMU. Okay.
So this is something we like to talk about a lot. So here's the thing. She was effectively barred from entering the what is now the U.S. Open. At the time, it was called the United States National Championships in Forest Hills. Official rules prohibited racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. That'd be bad. But how do you qualify to play in the highest level competition if you can't play the games that let you into that competition? You can't. So that's why the bootstraps just broke. Okay. They fell off the feet, so to speak. In 1950, so because America is just like such an asshole, there was intense lobbying by ATA officials and retired champion Alice Marble, who we could also be talking about, who published a scathing open letter in the magazine American Lawn Tennis. So because of pressure, which is why it's important to vote, to put pressure, to call, yep, she became the first Black player to receive an invitation to the Nationals, where she made her Forest Hills debut a few days after her 23rd birthday. So she lost only narrowly in the second round. It was rain delayed. It was complicated. Bet you she could have won. I'm just saying. I like her. So I think she could have won. But she lost to Louise Brott, who was the reigning Wimbledon champion and former U.S. national winner. And because this happened, she got famous. Lots of coverage. People are talking about her. There's a journalist quote, Lester Rodney wrote, quote, "No Negro player, man or woman, has ever set foot on one of these courts. In many ways, it is even a tougher personal Jim Crow busting assignment than was Jackie Robinson's when he first stepped out of the Brooklyn Dodgers dugout." End quote.
Oh, wow. So, and also, if you're going to lose to somebody,
right?
Who's a Wimbledon champion? Like,
and it was like a narrow loss.
Yeah.
Like, she was close.
Yeah.
She could have done it.
Yep.
So then she won her first international title in 1951, the Caribbean Championships in Jamaica, and later that year became one of the first Black competitors at Wimbledon, where she was defeated in the third round by Beverly Baker. In 1952, she was ranked seventh nationally by the USTA. So then she graduated college. Remember, she's still in college. She graduated college. She takes a job teaching physical education at a university. She becomes romantically involved with an army officer. And she, I don't know his name. She never named him. She was like, he's mine. No one touches him.
Boy toy. And, yeah.
Like, almost joined the army to follow him. But the State Department sent her on a goodwill tour of Asia in 1955 to play exhibition matches.
Really?
This is around Korean War time?
Yeah. I had no idea any of this happened. Wow.
Right? Like, she lived several lives. This is so in the book Born to Win, the authorized biography of Althea Gibson, which was published in 2004, it said that many Asians in the countries that they visited, quote, felt an affinity to Althea as a woman of color and were delighted to see her as part of an official U.S. delegation. With the United States grappling over the question of race, they turned to Althea for answers, or at least to get a firsthand perspective, end quote.
Now, what part of Asia? Was it all over East Asia?
Yeah, like, it's Burma, Ceylon,
India,
Pakistan, and Thailand. That's
Southeast and South Asia. Okay.
So, yeah, there's different, I mean.
So not Korea or Japan or China.
No. Okay. Which, I mean, I think there was a war going on, but.
Yeah. That would explain it.
But I think it's interesting because I do know that there's issues of racism in more than the United States.
Oh, yeah. Anti-Blackness, but also colonialism has done a number on different cultures throughout the world, especially during that time. So,
yeah.
You know, they also have intra-racial tensions. So,
yes.
Like East Asians have tension with the Southeast Asians and South Asians and, you know.
Yeah, I found it interesting and sort of surprising almost that they loved her and that they were.
I don't, because It sense in their minds, I think a lot of times it's like, oh, she's so different. Like I've said this often to people, you know, I love Japanese culture and
you do,
East Asian culture. And so I remember saying to a friend of mine, he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go on vacation. I'm like, you should go to Japan. You should go to Asia because as a Black person traveling, and this is now or like in the last 20 years or whatever. And now like, it's one of the few times where I'm not made aware that I'm Black, which is interesting.
Because you're just American?
Because I'm just American. And again, and this is different. Uh-huh. Visiting is very different than living, obviously. But even Black people living in Japan are like, oh, yeah, they don't see me as a Black American. I'm just an American, a gaijin, as they would say.
Okay.
And so it's a very unusual experience as a Black person when you have that experience, and whereas when you go to Europe, you're made aware of it. It is just like, you know, even when they stare, it's just a different kind of like, it doesn't feel disrespectful. I mean, that's been my experience. I mean, still don't touch my hair, but I have to admit the Japanese are very polite because they will ask. Yep. They don't just start petting you. They'll be like, oh, oh sugoi. And they'll be like, you know, they'll ask and then you're like, oh, okay. You know, but it's always like, wow. And I remember a friend of mine was saying, she's talking to this Japanese guy and he was like, he's like, Black hair is like magic hair because it could be very, very straight. Or it could be really, really curly and kinky. Like they're fascinated by like braids and like
straight.
Afros.
Yeah.
Like
everyone else is just jealous.
It is magical. I agree. Mm-hmm. but I digress. But no, I can understand, like, I would imagine it's a different political environment in the 50s, but they're probably like, oh my God, amazing. So
and that, I mean, I think that's when her relationship went away. She gained a lot of confidence. And I bet you part of that confidence, she wasn't battling the energy of the crowd. I think about that, right? They were just there for her. And
they were
she's
like, whoa.
Really,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. She stayed abroad. She then went on to win 16 of 18 tournaments in Europe and Asia against many of the world's best players. May 1956, she became the first African-American athlete to win a Grand Slam tournament, which is like the French Championships singles event. But then she also won the doubles title, partnered with Angela Buxton, who's British. And then she went on to win a whole bunch of other things. It's a long list. You guys can Google it. She just won. Lots of doubles, too. Angela Buxton, I think, was the person she played with the most. 1957, she says, quote, it was Althea Gibson's year. Yes, girl.
Oh.
She was seated first at Wimbledon. Seated is like a tennis term for like, I think she's going to win it. She is seated as,
okay.
Right? Like I'm a tennis, like I know things now. Okay. I did not know
excuse
before.
Excuse me. Excuse you.
I excuse me. I don't really know what I just said, but that's fine.
Miriam Williams. Okay. There you go. You're the third
right.
Williams sister.
The long lost sister, obviously.
That'd be a great sketch.
Oh, it would be a great. Hi. We look alike.
It's hilarious.
They're just rolling their eyes.
Oh,
who's
my
this
God.
Crazy lunatic person?
Because you know all the Williams are very tall people too. So
well,
like
that's why
there.
I fit right in, along with my many other attributes.
Yes,
and my ability at playing tennis.
You know, though, audience, they would be like, nah, I don't know. But then when Miriam turns around and showing that badonkadonk, they'd be like, oh yeah, she's part of the family.
You know, we're cousins. Okay, okay. My ancestors are somewhere in Africa and you know
it. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The butt don't lie, girl.
Mm-mm. A lot of people are jealous. It's fine.
Oh, yes, they are. They should be.
Yeah, they are. People are like, how did you get that? I was like, my parents. DNA. It was very stressful to have it in the 90s, but once the 2000s since it was fine.
Especially as a white girl around other white girls. Oh, I can't even imagine. Yeah,
it was rough. Did they sing Baby Got Back to Me in high school? Mm-hmm. They did. Yeah. They did. Very offensive? Probably.
Well, if you were in my camp, we'd be singing it, but it's adoration. We'd be like,
no, it was
girl.
Adoration. These boys were not hitting on me, but they weren't hitting on. It was, gotcha. But it was, yeah, I'm probably going to turn red right now remembering that feeling. Oh my Lord, but it happened. Yeah. It was real.
But I mean, listen, that's because you're the long lost William sister. I'm just saying.
That's exactly what I am. It makes sense. Never watch me play tennis. Okay. So she defeated Darlene Hard in the finals for the singles title. She was the first Black champion in the tournament's 80-year history. What? So she was the first Black champion in the tournament's 80-year history. Okay, this is Wimbledon, right? Uh-huh. So Wimbledon is in the UK. Okay, mm-hmm. You're going to be so excited about this because you're British in your heart. She was the first champion to receive the trophy personally from Queen Elizabeth II.
No.
Okay. Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think Queen Elizabeth II went, sorry for raiding everything? Do you think maybe she handed her some jewels back? No. I'm just saying.
She just didn't do that. And what year was this? It was
57? 57. 57.
Okay. All right. Wow.
Right?
Wow.
So she won the doubles championship also. She returned home and was the second Black American after Jesse Owens to be honored with a ticker tape parade in New York City. And she was awarded a bronze medallion, the city's highest civilian award. She then defeated Louise I'm so sorry, in straight sets to win her first U.S. national championship. She says, quote, "Winning Wimbledon was wonderful and it meant a lot to me, but there is nothing quite like winning the championship of your own country." Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Wow.
Okay. Then she went on to be amazing and amazing and amazing. Man, I'm not going to keep telling you all of the amazings. I could, but we don't have all day. So in late 1958, she did amazing well. She was winning. She was fabulous. Having won 56 national and international singles and doubles titles, she retired from amateur tennis. So before the Open era, there was no prize money at major tournaments. All of this to say, she wasn't making any money.
That's crazy.
Yeah, because this is amateur. And guess who couldn't play professional tennis yet? Women.
Snap. I didn't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Not even just Black women, but women.
All women.
Wow.
This is a quote, and you're going to love it, from Althea Gibson. "Being the queen of tennis is all well and good, but you can't eat a crown, nor can you send the Internal Revenue Service a throne clipped to their tax forms. The landlord and grocer and tax collector are funny that way. They like cold cash. I reign over an empty bank account, and I'm not going to fill it by playing amateur tennis."
I fucking love her. She's like, bitch, run me my money. This little crowd is fine and all, but where the money at?
That's a fact.
They're trying to get to the paper. Okay. I love this woman.
I do too. Yeah, say it like it is. You want these events and you make money on all these events. You make so much money. Mm-mm.
And this is also the difference. This is the difference, particularly during this time, between Black women and white women, because Black women are putting up with a whole bunch of bullshit. We ain't got time to be playing nice. Listen, I'm the queen of an empty bank account. Run me my money, motherfuckers. That's why they're like, black women talk too much. What's that? A closed mouth don't get fed? Like,
yeah.
Listen. Rub me my money. I love this woman. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I had no idea she was this feisty. I love it.
Yeah. Love it. As I was like, oh my God, the vet is going to die.
Oh my God. Love her.
So, I mean, she did like do some things, like she did a few things with the Harlem Globetrotters, but like nothing gave her that cash. So she had another dream as well. Did you know that she was a very talented singer and saxophonist?
No.
Yeah, no, but she is though. Yeah. She was a runner-up at the Apollo Theater's Amateur Talent Contest in 1943. Okay. She made... So all of the tennis is happening also made her professional singing debut at W.C. Handy's 84th birthday tribute at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in 1957. Okay. So an executive from Dot Records was impressed with her performance and signed her to record an album of popular standards. It was called Althea Gibson Sings, and it was released in 1959. She performed two of its songs on the Ed Sullivan Show in May and July of that year. Sales, unfortunately, were disappointing.
That's because people are like, the tennis girl sings? Because back then, you could like multitask. People are like, you either one thing or the other. Like,
I will say, they could not see a black woman be more than one thing. Because the level of talent she must have had to be like, oh, damn, well, you should do this. And then people were like, no. But she also appeared as a celebrity guest on What's My Line? Mm-hmm. And, okay, ready? She was cast in a movie. It's called, John Ford made it. It's a motion picture called The Horse Soldiers in 1959. And the way they wrote the script, as you can imagine, for her part, was less than appetizing for her. Mm. And the dialect they suggested she speak... She said no. And even though John Ford was notorious for being a dick, I mean, maybe, allegedly, don't come at me. He said okay and changed it. And that's what it was in the movie.
Oh, so they wanted her to do the mammy voice. Mm-hmm. Oh, eyes coming. Okay.
Yeah, they sure did.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In the 50s. Please.
Yeah. So she was like,
no.
I love her so much.
Because Althea's like, listen, I ain't got no money. You motherfuckers will buy my record. And now you want me to do mammy voice? Nope. Not happening, player. Right. Nope. Yep.
And I will say, like, while I love that she did that, and yes, girl, that's the only movie she's in. You know, he was like, she's difficult to work with, you know?
Or she's probably like, this sucks. It sucks.
You know why she thought that? Because it sucks.
Yeah.
That's why
making movies is not glamorous at all.
Oh, like, no. It's what's the opposite of glamorous? That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she worked as a sports commentator. She was appearing in print and television advertisements for various products. And then she started increasing her involvement in social issues and community activities. So she eventually, at the age of 37, because I'm not done with her many lives, became the first black woman to join the Ladies Professional Golf Association Tour. What?
Oh, that's right. I forgot she became a golfer. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Fun fact, though. Even though the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, this will surprise you. There was still discrimination in many of the hotels and clubs in the South.
I don't believe you, Miriam. Because
and also, yeah, no, I know. It's hard for you to believe.
Because as soon as they signed that paper, poof.
Everything was fair.
Everything was fair. Yep.
And in the North, she also had some of those same problems, which is also hard to believe because the North has always been anti-racist.
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry. Always. I got that whole sentence out of my mouth without laughing. And I would like some credit where credit is due. Okay. Thank you.
Not.
it's funny because it's sad. Yeah. So she did it though. She did it. Sometimes she had to change in her car. Sometimes she, you know, I assume sometimes it was challenging to find a place to go to the bathroom, but she did it. She just, she never made quite enough money in it. She did win though. She did amazing.
Imagine though, like Queen Elizabeth gave you an award.
Yes. Yeah.
Like they had a ticker tape. Is it ticker tape?
It is ticker tape.
Ticker tape parade in yep. New York City.
Yep. Yep.
Like you're celebrated, you know, and now you still have to change in your motherfucking car. Like, yeah. That's some bullshit, man.
Which is, again, weird because they signed like on the dotted line.
Yeah.
That same year. Huh. Yep. Hmm. Fascinating. And then she started playing tennis again? What? In her 40s. Unfortunately, because there was the professional league had started for women, but she was in her 40s, and so she couldn't compete in the same way. Which, yeah. You know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They're assholes. She began directing women's sports and recreation for the Essex County Park Commission in New Jersey. In 1976, she was appointed New Jersey's athletic commissioner, the first woman in the country to hold such a role. She then resigned because it seems like it was a bullshit job. They gave her no resources. That sounds right. Mm. She tried to run for Senate. She didn't win, but she didn't lose hard. She like didn't beat the big guy, but she did, you know, she won over other people. So, you know,
I love her pivoting. She's like, well, let's try this. Let's try that. Let's
she
try
just
this.
Kept pivoting. Like,
that's great. I had no idea any of this stuff when it came to Althea Gibson.
I mean, I also didn't mention she was married twice, no kids, to men. We don't need to worry about that. Neither lasted too long. So she retired from professional golf at the end of the 1978 season. So she's doing all these jobs, working for and still doing professional golf. Like, I can't even imagine what like a day in her life was like.
That's why, like, we all stand on the shoulders of people who come before us. And yes. Like nowadays, whether it's music, especially in entertainment and sports and things like that, like, they make so much money, you know, and I think that's probably started happening in probably like the late 90s, early 2000s, because, you know, or until you break, you know, you break through and you're on a Wheaties, you know, box.
Right.
That's
right.
Sort of like, I think actually Michael Jordan is the first sort of like athlete to like really enterprise on that with the help of his first wife, Juanita, who was like a business major who was like, oh, no, we need to look for endorsement deals. Like, all your money shouldn't be coming from this one thing. But even in that, the salaries are always getting paid more.
Right.
But, like, someone as, like, successful and amazing as her didn't get, like, a tenth of what she deserved financially. Probably a 20th of what she deserved.
Probably a 20th. She should be living Serena Williams' life, like, in one of the mansions.
Yep.
Because just like Serena, right? She earned that shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I bet you Venus and Serena would be the first ones to tell you because of Althea Gibson is the reason she broke down the barrier so we can come in and you know, and benefit. And that's why you have to honor these people.
Yes.
Because they took the hit. So, wow.
I love her so much. So, she had two cerebral hemorrhages in the late 80s and then had a stroke in 1992. Her medical expenses left her in dire straits. As we said, that should never have happened. So she reached out to multiple tennis organizations requesting help and none responded. Her former doubles partner, Angela Buxton, made Althea's plight known to the tennis community and raised nearly $1 million in donations from around the world.
Oh, what a good friend.
Yeah. She was a good friend.
Because she's probably like, this is some bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. P.S. She was Jewish. I'm just saying. So in 2003, she died on September 28th. from complications because she was getting ill. And she is buried in Orange, New Jersey.
Aww. I love that. But I love that at least she could feel the love with her friendship.
Yes.
You know, people poured it. Because people are probably like, well, yeah, I got to give her something. Like, it's like our heroes should not be going out like this. Like, they should not be struggling later in life financially.
And those organizations can suck a dick. Are you serious right now? I'll say it. Come at me. Okay, fine. Our producers will be mad. They can allegedly suck a dick. Is that better?
Allegedly.
That's better. Okay.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Oh, but I'm glad that she, in the end, she found the love, even though like you have to reach out. The fact that she had to even ask is an issue, but...
Yes.
I'm glad that somebody stepped up and, you know, and her friend. And this is why friendships are important. That's why I love you, Miriam. You are my friend.
I love you too, Loretta.
So thank you so much. Oh my God, we need a biopic because I need to see little Althea Gibson putting hands on these kids.
Oh my God. No, this is a mini series. This is like, I mean, it's going to listen. If you're listening, first of all, Lavetta and I are producers, obviously. Second of all, you're going to make so much money because it's like funny, but also struggle, but also like beautiful. And you can throw in some romance shit. I don't care. But like, come on, man.
But she's so much more interesting than I think the, and I get it, you know, especially the Black community, you want to put forth. This is when respectability politics were important because of the, you know, the civil rights movements, particularly in the 50s and the 60s. But I love that she was like, you can catch these hands.
I want to see the scene where she's walking into a segregated school for the first time and her rolling her eyes. And like some shit she might have to do, you know,
or I just love it. Like, I mean, my version of it, because it has to be ridiculous. She's walking in and the kids are like scowling at her, the racist kids. And she was like, you can catch these heads. And then they're looking
and they'll be scared. Black people are scary. Yeah.
It's like, don't let the tennis skirts fool you. Okay. Mm-hmm. You catch these hands. Oh my God, I love it. Oh, well, on that note, we go from one awesome bad girl, badass girl, rather, to another badass, but also kind of a bad girl, because you know I love a bad girl. I love
a bad
girl.
It's your favorite.
So to wrap up Black History Month, I didn't go murderess this time.
Oh, who are you?
So, you know, I know, right? But I went to an equally bad girl who is, because Black women are... very complex. Sometimes they're, you know, they're presentable and has a lot of poise on the tennis court, and then you catch these hands out in the streets, or they might become madams. So,
I'm so excited! I love a good madam. You know I do. Okay.
Yeah, you do. So my notorious woman this week is, to wrap up this month of Black History, is Lulu White.
Yes, I love her, but I don't really know much about her.
Okay, let's get into it. I love
but
this.
I've heard of her.
I was going to do somebody else, and I was like, no.
I'm your cool white friend. Okay, don't forget.
But I mean, all right, cool white friend. There should be a shirt. Cool white friend.
Oh, God, no.
I'm a cool white friend. No, I'm telling you, we will sell out.
Okay.
Now, Lulu White was born Lulu Henley, circa 1868, but her exact date of birth is unknown, as she often concealed her real age as well as her identity. So
she's 23 forever. Got it.
Forever. Now, even though records show that she was probably born on a farm near Selma, Alabama, she would often claim to be an immigrant from the West Indies, Jamaica, Cuba, you pick it, because back then people thought, oh, if I'm some other place and I look Black, that means I'm not quite Black, you know.
Right.
It's like Costa Green kind of thing. Like, I'm Portuguese. Yes. Like, that's a Negress. I can tell a Negress when I see one. So Lulu would be like, oh, yeah. She'd be like, oh, I'm from Jamaica or Cuba or Alabama. Okay. All right. Which I find hilarious.
Pick one.
But she did this in order to give an air of exoticism, which again, right. this is like within 20 years, 20, 25 years of the end of slavery and the end of the Civil War.
So yeah.
In the South. So, but whatever she was, whatever her mix, she was just a Black American woman.
Yeah.
We just know that. Very light skin, which a lot of Black Americans can be. So she would claim mixed race heritage and would often pass herself off as a Black Creole from near or just outside the New Orleans area.
Okay.
Area. So basically she came to town. She was like, yeah, I'm from Cuba, Jamaica, a West Indian. This is why I look like this.
Cuba, India.
Hey, girl, you just light skinned it. Okay. So, but she came to the New Orleans area. And in the area, as we know, it's very famous for being a melting pot, having Black Creoles, Spanish Creoles, all kinds of Creoles. But this is also when the term Creole is starting to kind of be used outside of New Orleans as like, oh, light-skinned Black people who may have multiracial heritage, even though much to the frustration of like white Creoles, there's different kinds of Creoles. So
I thought Creole was very specific to the region.
Exactly. But it eventually became known as, like, nowadays when we say, oh, that ain't nothing but a Creole, it's usually a lighter skinned Black person. But
Creole, okay,
is a very specific thing to the area, and you have different kinds of Creoles. So, and the white Creoles were not very happy about people considering.
They can suck it. It's fine.
Yeah, they can suck it because it's just anti-Blackness. So, now when she first arrived in the area, it seems that she had a rough time of it, you know. Records show that she tried and failed at a couple business ventures. And she even has a criminal record that extended back in New Orleans as far back as the 1880s.
Oh, wow. Okay?
Now, all of it is kind of very hazy. But what we do know is that around this time, she posed for a series of nude/pornographic photos.
Okay. Make your money.
Circulating during that time. Now, it's not clear why it was an attempt to make money by selling them as cards, or as, you know, so she wouldn't have to do actual sex work, or was it advertisement for clients for actual sex work? So it's kind of, we don't really know, but knowing Lulu, it probably was some advertisers like, listen here, this is what you're getting. So you need to pay top dollar. Okay. Come and get this. Now she also, again, all of it is kind of hazy, but she then first appears in the city directory in 1888 in New Orleans.
Okay.
And a neighborhood comprised of, quote unquote, colored female boarding houses and brothels.
Okay.
So even though she's out here telling people, oh, I'm from the West Indies, whatever that is, she's in a boarding houses and brothels that are under the colored banner, which AKA is Black. I have some African friends who are like, color doesn't mean Black. I'm like, in America, colored means Black. Okay.
Wait, what do they think it means?
Well, because in some parts of Africa, but I'm thinking specifically South Africa, you know, you have Blacks, coloreds, and then whites. So colors are, yes. So, and I'm like, well, in America, color means Black. You know what I mean here. Okay. Now at the time, so at this time, Lulu was down, but Lulu White was not out because whatever her age, racial background or makeup, she was a very lighter skinned woman. And because of this, she would be able to access some privileges, at least in the sex work trade of New Orleans. So during this time, Louisiana had a period known as the Storyville period. Now, side note, Storyville was the red light district of New Orleans from 1897 to 1917.
Oh, the wow.
The district was established by a city alderman by the name of Sidney Story, who wrote guidelines and legislation to control prostitution within the city. Okay. So the ordinance designated an area about 16 blocks, some say 12 blocks, but most people agree it's around 16 blocks of the city in which prostitution, although still illegal, was tolerated and or regulated.
But I'm a big fan for like regulating, testing. We're all going to do it. Let's keep it safe.
I am too, you know? But his reason behind it is not so good. He was
okay. That makes sense.
You know, he's one of these self-righteous, probably doing terrible things in his home, you know, moral police kind of guy. Mm. And what pisses me off, because on the outside, you're like, oh, that's a good idea. What pisses me off is that he purposefully designated the area in a mostly black working class neighborhood.
He's a fucking asshole. That's what he is. An alleged fucking asshole.
Yeah. But sometimes
but I think the
racist,
rumors are true.
But sometimes racists and terrible people get their comeuppance because, much to his chagrin, the area suddenly became gentrified because of the new order.
Yes.
So basically, he was like, yeah, let's put him over there with the blacks and the Negroes and, you know, over there. And because of that, what he did not realize is that most men, particularly wealthy, privileged men, will have access to women, all kinds of women.
All kinds of women. Yep.
And this is New Orleans, by the way. Okay. So
also that.
The city's already known as like you can drink and party, and it's a great city. It's a great city even today. So because of this designation, all of a sudden, business savvy people like Lulu and many others, and who had relationships, either personal or a business, with really rich white men who were like, yeah, we want some of that. So the area actually became gentrified, and it pushed out the working class black people who were like church going, who were like, so it pushed them out because rent skyrocketed and property value skyrocketed.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah. So it basically gentrified overnight, like literally as soon as they signed it, people were like, okay. And again, because of this ordinance, Lulu, with her a savvy business sense, she saw an opportunity to end sex work for herself and become a businesswoman.
Right.
So one way she did this is that she opened up her own brothel. She had it built and she called it, quote, the Octoroon Parlor. She called it an Octoroon Parlor. Now, side note.
Okay. Yes.
Now, an octoroon is basically a person who has 1/8 black, but who present as very light skin or white passing, right? But because this is New Orleans, everybody knows everybody's business. Everyone, it's whatever, right? So basically, you would have a great-grandparent who's black. So a lot of times women who are just lighter skin, first it would be like, I'm a quadroon, meaning I'm a quarter black. So I have a grandparent who's black. But then it became octoroon, and they kind of like, for the most part, people kind of use them interchangeably. You know, there's an old saying that like Southern black folks would be like, they ain't nothing but an octoroon, meaning it's just a light skinned black person.
Okay.
So that's why when she traded on there, she's basically exploiting the racial mixing, but also the because of racism, white supremacy, and the hypersexualization of black people, she's exploiting the exoticism around the idea of octoroons and quadroons, right?
Yeah.
So these women present mostly as white, but then there's that eighth part of them that's animalistic and probably exciting and, you know? So,
right.
So she opened up her her brothel called Mahogany Hall, where she would employ only ladies who were quote unquote octoroons.
Or like light skinned black women.
Yeah.
Like,
right. That, I mean, we know that, but she marketed as that, right?
Right. Because they're not walking in with paperwork and family trees, you know?
Like her.
Right.
So she opened up Mahogany Hall, which is, it was famously called, and it was located at 235 Basin Street. Now, the four-story house she built reportedly cost about $40,000 to build, which is about $1.4 million in today's money.
Damn.
Yeah. It was four stories. So if she's spending that on to build a house, you can imagine that she was making a lot of money.
She was raking it in. Okay.
She and reportedly, from publicity stills of the time, Mahogany Hall had, like I said, four stories, five parlors, one of which was a mirrored parlor, 15 bedrooms, each with its own adjoining bathroom.
Ooh, that's nice.
Which was unheard of at the time. Famous Storyville photographer E.J. Bellick, he has some surviving photos of the house, and in it you see it has like elegant furnishings, huge chandeliers, potted ferns. It housed several expensive oil paintings, Tiffany stained glass windows, and a swirling mahogany staircase.
Wow. I'm going to be looking up these pictures.
Yeah. And apparently she was making so much money. She wore so many jewels, mostly diamonds, diamond bracelets up like halfway up her arm.
Wow.
Rings on every finger, layers of diamond necklaces that she called herself. And she was actually called the Diamond Queen.
Okay.
Okay. This is how much money she was making. Real diamonds. These are real diamonds, people. Now, the house publicity pamphlets, and what she did was, so in the area, they had something known as the Blue Book. So the Blue Book was basically a listing of all the brothels in Storyville.
Oh. Okay.
And it would list the house, the owner, the proprietor, and a basic sort of summary. There was also a competing publication called The Red Book. And in my research, I found a listing for Lulu's Place, and it said that it had about 40 girls. Okay. And in both pamphlets, it would have basically a headshot and a summary of the girls.
Okay.
Yeah.
Takes me back to my theater days, but okay.
So it'd have like a featured, I guess it was a Tinder and the dating apps before, but for
there you go.
Work. Okay.
Yeah.
And so it had featured photographs and biographies of each octoroon girl.
Okay.
And one of them contained supposedly a picture of Lulu herself, but actually most people believe it was a picture of one of her girls, a woman by the name of Victoria Hall. Now, this place, in addition to the 40 girls, right, the place employed maids, bartenders, wait staff, and even the Jelly Roll Morton.
What?
Who was among the pianists who performed for the clients in Mahogany Hall.
While,
so there was always a live piano, live music.
Oh, God.
And then sometimes the women would do the naked dance. They would be hanging from the chandeliers and like, while customers drank French champagne.
Okay.
So this was the place to be.
I mean, that sounds kind of fun. Honestly, I just don't want to have sex with strangers. Other than that.
I mean, it's like, it's like a upscale strip place that has excellent food, because you know the food was banging, especially
in
New Orleans. You know the food was amazing.
Yeah. Like I would go. I would just like not have sex with anybody.
But also, and also it was so popular that a song was even written about it called "The Mahogany Hall Stomp," written by Spencer Williams and performed by Louis Armstrong.
Oh my God!
As a record leader. Yeah.
Wow.
This is how popular it was. It was basically Lulu had finally made it. She was the it girl of Storyville. And this was kept up by the fact that a lot of her clients were some of the most prominent and wealthiest men in Louisiana.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, which is why she, like I said, she wore so many jewels that they said that one person said of her, quote, she had so many jewels, which, quote, which were like the lights of the St. Louis Exposition, end quote.
Oh my
That's
God.
How she was. And she wore a bright red wig along with a diamond tiara.
I love that.
always draped in like the finest of the finest, but like a lot of it. Now, at the height of her career as a madam, Lulu White had, like I said, many powerful associates, and she was also called ostentatious and infamous and notorious.
Yeah,
and she even earned from the press the moniker, quote, the quote, notorious negress, end quote.
Oh, well then.
The notorious negress.
Okay.
She flouted the rules of Jim Crow and flaunted her wealth and connections. And the thing about also Lulu is a hot mess, because mahogany was very expensive and it was also racially exclusive. So again, although the women were purported octoroons, only white men were allowed to patronize them.
What the fuck, Lulu?
Yep. Lulu's like, I'm getting to that paper. That's what I'm doing. Now, side note, sometimes, especially in this era,
yeah,
white women would pretend to be octoroons.
Yeah.
Because they could get a higher rate.
I could walk in and get a job immediately. I'd be like, let me turn around. I'm hired. Maybe not now, maybe 20 years ago, but still.
No, but actually, you know, it reminds me of that. You know what blackfishing is, right?
No. You know,
so blackfishing is white girls pretending to be mixed girls online.
Oh, my God.
So they're pretending to do baby hair and what? Braids. And it's basically, what's that white lady was pretending to be black?
Rachel Dolezal. Yeah.
Yeah. But online. So they're pretending to be specifically, because they obviously can't pretend to be somebody like me. They're pretending to be mixed girls specifically a lot of times.
I was just kidding. Why?
Because they think they're going to get more. A, they're considered prettier. And B, they're going to get more likes, because people be like, oh, your hair. And there's this whole thing with the black hair care community online. But this reminds me. So they've been doing this since like the 1890s, like trying to get that money. Now, in addition to Mahogany Hall, and also because a lot of Lulu's clients were like really wealthy and like connected men.
Yeah.
So you want to get access to that kind of clientele who may or may not be going over to the halls that are exclusively for white women. So because also the brothels had to be separate. So you could either do, which is why Lulu is also special in that sense that you could, they either had to have black women or white women. But Lulu was saying, oh, octoroons, which in New Orleans, it only works in New Orleans because of the racial makeup of New Orleans and the melting pot that it is. So, and also because the women often appear, they were so light skin, you know, and maybe there's a hint of like, you know, they all kind of look like Mariah Carey or Meghan Markle, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, and then imagine if Meghan Markle bleached her hair, made it lighter, or was a redhead, right?
Okay.
So that's what I'm kind of saying. But Meghan Markle and Mariah Carey, I'm just, again, because I'm a black person from the South, I'm like, they're just light-skinned black women, octoroons, whatever.
Yep.
And Meghan Markle's mother is actually black, so it's not even like she
would
qualify.
I was going to say, she's not an octoroon, and she's half black.
But see, that's what I mean. She still would qualify because it's on looks versus
I would qualify.
Yes, you could, Miriam. That badonkadonk. I'm telling you, walk in there and be like, yes, I'm an octoroon. And Lulu would be like, all right, go upstairs and get your robe. Okay.
You're right.
We're doing this.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, in addition to Mahogany Hall, Lulu operated an adjacent drinking establishment on Basin Street called Lulu White's Saloon, which opened in 1912, as well as she reportedly had other real estate property throughout the city. Now, it was the success of Mahogany Hall, because you can just imagine, like, they're making it rain. It's all cash. Yeah. Like, they're making it rain air night on the night. Okay, she making so much money. So much so that she was one of the few only Black self-made millionaires at the beginning of the century.
Oh, wow.
Along with CJ, Madam CJ Walker.
Was just trying to give some hair care.
I probably want to do it Madam CJ Walker's way, but hey, if you're into this life, you bought that life, she was indeed a boss bitch. Now, unfortunately, like with all good things, eventually it has to end. So with the advent of the 1920s, the call for prohibition got louder.
Yeah.
And also the moral police of, because I would imagine if I'm not into this, I would be horrified at the idea of Storyville. Like if I'm just like a regular, especially if I'm a
witch. I wouldn't go near it. Like to the truth is, of the matter is I would be so terrified of any of those streets. I was a very scared child.
But you can imagine that the wealthy white women's husbands know their husbands are over in Storyville and are pissed.
I'd be pissed.
Yeah. As well as the, you know, we've always had religious zealots, Christian religion. Yeah. So the fundamentalists, that kind of thing, they were like horrified. And so without the protection, so throughout the 20s, without the protection of the Storyville Ordinance, which ended in 1917,
right,
things, her fortune started to change. And then she would be basically arrested constantly on, you know, operating illegally, a brothel, and on the Volstead Act or the Prohibition Act, which was ratified in 1919. So things started changing in 1917, 1919, which she said publicly that she switched from alcoholic drinks to soft drinks. But we all know.
Of course, nobody did.
Yeah. I mean, the mob made a whole fortune from Prohibition.
So much money.
So, but clients knew she still had the good stuff somewhere. So she kept getting arrested on and off. Now, mostly, like I said, for a disorderly house or selling liquor illegally. But she also was arrested for violent offenses, including attempted murder.
Oh, my God. Jesus.
Lulu's like, you gonna get these hands. Like Althea Gibson, you gonna get these hands, okay? She did not serve any jail time like through most of this time, except when Storyville closed down in 1917. So on November 6, 1918, she was arrested for violating the Draft Act, which prohibited prostitution within a 10 miles of a military facility, which they had recently built a naval port, a naval facility nearby. And so basically her brothel was right near. And again, World War I is going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So her sentence was a year and a day in a penitentiary. She served about 3 years, but then applied for pardon from President Woodrow Wilson, who was one of the most vehement racists.
He hated Black people.
Yeah, presidents of all time. But he commuted her sentence because she appealed to him because she was sick, she said. She's like, I'm sick.
Okay, also that she's light-skinned, and that probably helped because he's an asshole.
It could
be
some
people. He's an alleged asshole.
People in his administration who may have been clients, who knows? Madams usually have a long list, allegedly.
The alleged thought that that's what happened, because I really enjoy that idea.
Yeah, because we know it's not because he liked Black people at all. So he released her, he pardoned her, and she was released. She immediately went back to Louisiana and started up business again.
That's right.
Now, eventually, what took her out wasn't even the end of the ordinance or prohibition. It was the war.
Oh,
that was the thing that she couldn't really skirt by interacting with the military. And, you know, the guys are going to go over there. Like, come on. It's their guys.
They're going to go somewhere. The whole idea of like, you can't set up here. You have to make them walk 10 miles and 4 minutes. Yeah. Come on,
because they passed an ordinance that you couldn't have a brothel within 5 miles of a base. But it's so interesting. She was already there. They built the base near her. Yeah, so
that's your problem.
She tried to make it work for a while, but it began to take its toll. And then in 1906, before that, she ran into some financial difficulties because you wonder, like, OK, she's having this hard time. 1912, 1917, like, why is she, you know, 1917, 1918? Why is she not giving up? Because earlier, a few years earlier in 1906, she had given a lover of hers a bunch of money to go out to Hollywood, to come out to Hollywood to buy a studio in the fledgling motion picture industry.
OK, wait, go on.
So she was like kind of seeing the writing on the wall. What is my retirement plan? What am I going to do? So she had visited California and really loved that it was wide open. And she saw like an opportunity to get in on the ground floor. And this is like 1902, 1903. She came out. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So she had heard about the fledgling motion picture industry. So she sent out a some people say that he was a lover of hers as well. She gave him about $150,000 in
damn.
That, which today is between, it's about $5.5 million.
Holy crap.
So she gave it to him to come out, travel by train or whatever, to come out and make the purchase. He disappeared with the money.
What a fucking asshole.
So you can imagine if she's out of that much money in 1906 and other bad business dealings, what have you, like she's out of a lot of money. So that's why she's still holding on. Because she's probably thinking between 1906 and 1917, I can make it up. But no one knew it was going to end in 1917. So she's probably just going along spending as much as she's spending, da da da, who knows what kind of house, you know, like expenses she had. But that was really, really devastating to her. So in 1917 and 18 and 19, she's having all these.
And she's in jail from what years?
No, she was only in jail for 3 months in 1918.
I was 3 months. I thought you said 3 years. I was very confused.
No. So,
but I, you know, my cognitive abilities are not as great these days. It's fine. That's me.
No. Okay. So, no, this, I mean, some of our listeners might be confused. So basically, the ordinance ended in 1917.
Right. Okay? Prohibition, she was arrested.
Yeah. She was arrested in 1918.
Right.
Prohibition was enacted in 1919.
Okay. I literally thought you said she was arrested for a year, she was in jail for a year and a day, but then was in jail for 3 years. And I was very confused, but that's not what you said.
No,
cognitive abilities are very important.
She was sentenced to a year and a day, but she only served 3 months.
Okay. And that's where Woodrow Wilson was bribed, allegedly. Okay.
Allegedly. So this is a woman who, imagine you're living a high life and then you lose all this money in 1906 and you're thinking, okay, I can make it back. It's, you know, it's devastating. And then in 1917, you lose basically all of your protection, right?
Right.
So then I would imagine the money stops almost immediately. So you're like, well, we still have some customers. And then, which is why she got arrested in 1918. And then when you get out and go back to doing it, prohibition hits and you're like, damn it. But really what took her out was the war and that whole thing about not being close to
the war was over. That war was over by then.
Yeah, but the war's over. And then what comes during that year after the Spanish flu?
Fuck. Yep. Sure does.
Yep. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, we can even track it. 1917. So Storyville, the ordinance ended November 12th, 1917, right?
Right.
November the following year, 1918, she's arrested.
Right.
Because she no longer has the protection of the ordinance. So she's arrested. But the naval base is already there, like you said.
Right.
Because the war is going. So she's trying to make money again because she lost all her money in 1906. She's trying to hold on. And then 1919, the war ends. But then the Spanish flu comes and starts killing everybody. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but she's still holding on. She's like, I got to make this work. Right. So she was arrested And it's starting to take its toll on her because she was arrested. And one of the most famous mugshots of her is an older lady, wig slightly askew, with a look on her face like, this is some bullshit. She is not happy. And it's from 1920.
Wow.
Her face says it all. And basically, remember when Danny Glover kept saying in Lethal Weapon, I'm too old for this shit.
Yes.
If that was a person, it'd be Lulu White's mugshot from 1920. She's just like, I'm too old for this shit. So for a while, she commuted back and forth between California and Louisiana just to kind of save face that she was still there. But eventually, Storyville, after the demise of it in 1917, and like I said, Spanish flu, she had to call it quits. So unfortunately, in 1929, though, she sold the saloon to a New Orleans businessman, and Mahogany Hall was sold for $11,000, which was about $198,000 in today's money.
That's like not a lot of money, actually.
No, imagine she spent about $1.4 billion to build it, and you're getting $198,000?
I mean, was it maybe dilapidated?
Well, it's also 1929, you know, around that time. So again, Spanish flu's hit, all this stuff. So the heyday is long gone. You know, you're 10 years beyond the heyday.
So sad. Yeah.
Now, after this, not much is known of her whereabouts and her life, but jazz historian Al Rose sought some documentation of her death, and he believes that she died at the residence of former Madame Willie Piazza, one of Lulu White's contemporaries and also a well-known former madam of Storyville. So he believed that Lulu White died in 1931. But a teller at a New Orleans bank reported that in 1941, she saw Lulu White make a withdrawal. So, but none of that has really been corroborated. But the accepted death date is 1931. But who knows, you know?
Oh, now I'm like,
so
that's fascinating.
Now, Mahogany Hall itself would, after it was sold, would go on to service the house for the unemployed in the mid-1940s and then be demolished in 1949.
Yeah. I'm horrified that they demolished it.
Yeah. Now, her saloon, which was nearby, Mahogany Hall, was one of the handful of buildings from Storyville to survive past 1940s, but it would suffer damage from Hurricane Betsy in 1965, losing its second floor. So basically what remains of it is a ground floor. And I think the last research I saw the past couple of years, it's like a local seafood spot.
Okay.
And it's just one story in that area. Now, Lulu, like I said, was extremely notorious, and the notorious Negress. She was extremely popular, not just for being so like ostentatious and very wealthy and wearing all of these diamonds, but her lore also got, because remember, a lot of people coming into New Orleans and leaving and going to other parts of the country. So she has been imitated and admired in popular culture. For instance, a little bit on the appropriation tip, Mae West herself, the Mae West, was accused of appropriating. We love Mae West, but she was she was accused of appropriating some of the signature aspects of Lulu White in her characterizations, in her characters of Diamond Lil on the stage. So Diamond Lil was a play that she put on the stage. And later in the film, Belle of the 90s, that came out in 1934, that was heavily influenced by Diamond Lil, which is many believe is based on Lulu White, especially. So Belle of the 90s from 1934, the original working title was called The Belle of New Orleans.
Okay, so probably yes, allegedly.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then in 1978, there was a film called Pretty Baby, a brothel madam played by Frances Fay wears a red wig and a lot of jewelry.
Okay, yeah, that's her. They took it.
And then a lot of the characters in the brothel had characteristics of Mahogany Hall employees and ladies, as well as the actual set pieces, including a swirling mahogany staircase. And then Lulu White appears in a fictional character in three of David Fulmer's Storyville mysteries.
Oh.
So, and also, side note, there's like Lulu White's like restaurants and bars, and like there's one in France, and then there's one really? In like the Netherlands somewhere. Like, so she, Lulu White is one cool. of the stars of Storyville, because the idea of Storyville is just crazy.
Yes.
The fact that this was going on. And again, it was from 1897 to 1917. So for 20 years.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yep.
I mean, kind of cool. Like, I would never walk on those streets because, again, a very scared child. But it's so fascinating.
As an adult, I'd probably go down there like for an evening out, like, because, you know, like, not into the brothels, but like, you know, they had fancy restaurants and
oh, that's true,
cafes
yeah.
and like
yeah
shows.
In my 30s I would have been like, yeah, calm down, let's go check it out.
Exactly. Like, so okay. That is Lulu Very... White.
I love her. Thank you so much for bringing her. She's a fascinating woman. Like, I have heard of her, but I didn't know the details.
You know, I think what I love about this episode is I think this is the first episode that I could see these two women actually having a good time together.
Yes. Actually, yes. They would get along beautifully.
They would get along. You know, and Althea would be like, girl, now you know you ain't no Octoroon, girl. You're just light-skinned from Alabama.
She'd be like, stop talking.
But I love it. I also love that Lulu would have done so well in Hollywood, because basically she created her own lore, her mythology.
Listen, she would have been like the highest powered producer, creator. I mean, do you know what I'm saying? Like, she has that in her, and the drive, not just the creative ability, but the drive to do it.
Yeah, if she had been amazing. Able to come out in 1917 or 18 after fucking Birth of a Nation in 1915 to counterbalance
yes.
those racist images. I mean, knowing Lulu, she probably would have been like, yes, I'm from the West Indies. And people would be like, no, there's black people in the West Indies.
I don't think she would have countered anything, but
that's the majority of the West Indies. It's like, girl. But she's a fun character. We love Lulu White. She looked like she seemed like she would definitely punch you like diamonds and
all. I would be very afraid of her. Like,
yeah, but a good time.
And that's fine.
A good time. All right, guys, that wraps it up for the latest episode of Notorious Women. Again, follow us on all the things. Like, subscribe. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that like button, hit that subscribe button. And also go to all of our socials, which Miriam is going to tell you about, and support the show. Also before that, remember you can support us on patreon.com/notoriouswomen, and Patreon is spelled patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support the show?
You can follow us on all of the things. We're on all of the things. So Instagram, Notorious Women Podcast, TikTok, Notorious Women Podcast. The YouTube is Notorious Women Podcast. All the things. Like us, follow us, talk to us, because that's where you can talk to us. You can DM us on Instagram if you want. You can also email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. And that is that.
Also, our website, Notorious
Women. We have a website.
Podcast. Yes. NotoriousWomenPodcast.com.
That's right.
And this was so much fun.
Yeah, this was a fun one.
Yeah. All right, guys. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.